Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Well, we begin this morning with some music. Flo McSweeney had one of the most exciting careers in this country as a singer with a beautiful voice in bands such as Les Enfants, Moving Hearts, and then presenting TV shows and acting on stage. But then, in her early 20s, she was also signed by Virgin Records. But she gave it all up to raise her two children. But now she's back and she's got a new album, Picture in a Frame. And I'm pleased to say Flo is here with me this morning, along with the album's producer, Fiacre Trench. Thanks so much for coming in on Mother's Day, both of you.
Thank you. Happy Mother's Day.
Delighted. So listen, briefly, we're going to talk later on as well, but how did this album come about, Flo?
I've been working with Fiacre and his wife, Carmel. We have a show called Two Divas and a Piano, and we've been gigging for 2 years. So it just was a natural progression from sort of live work into the studio. And it kind of all happened organically.
Which is great. And of course, Fiacre, you are responsible for the string arrangements on such great hits as the Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays, the Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York. A stellar career.
Well, it's been a wonderful privilege, really, to work on such tracks. Happy is the man who can make a living out of his hobby.
Yeah, absolutely,
yeah,
which is great. And so when did you and Flo start working on this album?
About this time last year. Mm-hmm. Well, it was about the end of April. Yeah. We went in and started recording. And it was the bones of the summer. It took
quite a long gestation.
Yeah,
that's fine.
But I enjoyed every minute of it. Yeah. Love being in the studio was great. Yeah.
And is it almost sweeter, Flo, to be doing it now than, as I say, you know, you were signed in your early 20s by Virgin Records. Is it almost sweeter to be doing it now?
Completely. I think it's because there's less to prove in some way. I'm doing it for totally different reasons. I'm sort of doing it because it was kind of bubbling up in me and I had to do it, and I didn't really think about what I would do afterwards, you know, whether it would be a success or not. To me, it's a massive success because I've done it.
Yeah. You have a beautiful voice. And of course, Picture in a Frame, it's the song by Tom Waits and Kathleen Brennan, I think. Why did you call the album then? Why do you love that song?
It's a strange thing. I when I heard the song, I instantly connected with the song. And I very much think of my mother because we have this gorgeous photograph of my mother in a frame that was there forever. And my mother died last April, on the 12th of April. And I sang Picture in a Frame at her funeral. And Fiacre played piano for me. And then it just became that there was never going to be any other song that was the title track of the album. So I want to dedicate it to my mum because it's my first year on Mother's Day without having her.
Well, look, Flo and Fiacre, off you go. You're going to listen now and play for us Picture in a Frame. Let's listen to it. And you're going to come back later on at the end of the show and chat to me again.
Great.
Off you go.
Sun came up, it was blue and cold. The sun came up, it was blue and gold. The sun came up, it was blue and gold. Ever since I put your picture in a frame, I come calling in my Sunday best. I come calling in my Sunday best. I come calling in my Sunday best. Ever since I've put your picture in a frame, I'm gonna love you till the wheels come off. Oh, yeah. love you, baby, and I always will. I love you, baby, and I always will. I love you, baby, and I always will. Ever since I put your picture in a frame, ever since I put your picture in a frame.
Beautiful. Flo McSweeney and Fiacre Trench, thanks so much. You two are going to come over and come back at the end of the show perform for me again. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Mary.
Meanwhile, next month, My Father's Kind, a collaboration of poetry and music celebrating many great 20th century figures in traditional Irish music with Dermot Bulger, Danny Diamond, Sheila Freed and MacDara Yeats, is going to be on at the Taylor's Hall in Dublin on April the 12th. And it's all a part of Music Town Festival. For more information on that, the website is musictown.ie. But I'm delighted to say that Dermot Bulger, writer par excellence, and his collaborator MacDara Yeats, join me now in studio. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for coming in. So Dermot, whose idea was this? How did the collaboration come about?
Well, Sammy Cahn, the American songwriter, was once asked what came first, the music or the lyrics, and he said the phone call. And so it was the email. MacDara suggested it. And it's great to work with. I've done 60 this year, which is a great shock to the system. So it's great to work with young musicians. It's great. And because writers lead very solitary lives. And the thing of going on stage with a group of musicians like Danny and Sheila and Dara here, it's just great fun. It's just a great energy that is. So I'm really looking forward to collaborating.
And MacDara, from your point of view, how did it come about?
Yeah, I'd actually attempted about 5 years ago when I was pretending to be a filmmaker to work with Dermot, and it didn't work out at all. This project came about relatively quickly, which makes me feel like I switched to the right field eventually.
Absolutely.
To music. Yeah.
And of course, Dermot, you already had a suite of poems, didn't you, about some of these legends of Irish music? Tell us about that.
I had a suite of poems called Frost's All Over, which I did with the great Tony McMahon and with David Power, the piper. And we did it in I think it was in New York and in Scotland and places. But actually, they wanted me to do to perform the poems in a way that I wasn't that comfortable with. So I wasn't, I like to sit down and just let the poems say the words. So I was on a plane to New York, and the producer phoned me and said, "Dermot, you wouldn't mind if we just sacked you, because you don't make a very convincing Dermot Bulger." And I said, "No, I'm the least convincing Dermot Bulger I know." So they brought in an actor, Eamon Hunt, who played me in the main
things.
Which was much better. I actually wanted Eamon Hunt to take over my entire life, actually, but unfortunately, I'm still here. But it was actually, that was very interesting, because also, I don't know much about traditional Irish music. I know it and I love it, but there's all these stories that I didn't know, and I knew some of them growing up, but also talking to people like Tony McMahon, even talking to people like MacDara of a different generation, you find out so much about them, and these figures that were just names when you're growing up suddenly become living people, dead people now, but their lives come living. And it's been a great pleasure in recent years, get to know John Sheen really, really well.
Yeah,
you're talking to him and all these extraordinary names come out, just not as musicians, but as his friends.
And you're going to read for us in a moment your poem to Seamus Ennis, but just for my listeners, remind people who he was. I know you never met him, but of course this year we're celebrating the centenary of his birth. What do we know about him? I think he lived in his later years in a caravan in the Knoll.
He lived in mobile home called Isa Snow in the Knoll, and I was the worst library assistant in the history of Dublin County Council, and I was banished to the Siberian salt mines of the mobile libraries, and I would go to Knoll, but I never had the courage to go and knock on his door. He seemed this extraordinary old man. He was actually 63 when he died, but when I grew up in Finglas, there weren't that many cultural icons of the area to look up to. Now you have people who are from Finglas, like Aslam and the great Paul Meehan. You have people who want to pretend they're from Finglas, like you too. But when I was growing up, there was just Seamus Ennis, and he was born on Jamestown Road. There was a whiff of sulphur about him, and he was a master musician who didn't suffer fools gladly. And so, just the fact of this man who made music, his Pipes were extraordinary. His father was walking through London in 1908 and found a sack in a London pawnbroker's and recognised them as old Illan pipes and brought them back. And they were the pipes his father played, the pipes Seamus played. And when Seamus died, he passed them on to Liam O'Gofflin, and Liam O'Gofflin played them until his recent tragic death. And so he was a great musician. He didn't have a career in the sense of actually having... his address was very often care of a poor bar, care of friends, but like he was a maverick who really encouraged music if it was good.
Well, we're just going to, just before you read the poem, let's have a little flavour. We have Seamus Ennis here playing his pipe so brilliantly. Let's listen to Seamus now. Seamus Ennis, what made him so brilliant, do you think, Dermot?
I think he grew up in a family of musicians in Finglas. His father was a piper, his mother played a thing, and he was surrounded by music. And I think if you're immersed in it, you actually begin to get down to the essence. Talking to Tony McMahon was extraordinary about him because Tony really understood how to get inside the tune and inhabit the tune, and you serve the tune. And the poem actually is, Tony McMahon told me he shared a bed and breakfast, small bedsit on Home Farm Road with Seamus Ennis, and he just talked about him. And so whenever I walked on Home Farm Road, I see Ennis's ghost gone off to play some gig in some tiny pub.
Okay, your poem, Dermot, which is the title?
The title is called Seamus Ennis in Dunkondra.
Off you go, Dermot.
And it's in some ways the voice of Tony McMahon, really, because I never shared a flat with Seamus. I see him leave that flat we shared and walk down Home Farm Road, black coat buttoned against the wind, a countryman's hat pulled down, and in his hand a battered case containing the set of Illan pipes found in fragments by his father in a sack in a London pawnbroker's, a jigsaw nobody else could piece together 100 years after they were crafted by Kine of Thomas Street in Dublin. He carries his case like a secret dossier that no passerby could decode as he boards a bus into the city unnoticed among the evening hoods. Times are hard, a flat treadbare. He survives on tins of steak and kidney pie, on meals that he cooks at odd hours when he tells yarns and truly comes alive. There is rent to pay, a meter to be fed, afternoon visits to the local laundrette, nights of wind rattling the rotting windows when he spreads his coat over his bed. This is the price of making music, of living the life for which he was born. He is on his way that night to perform for a little pay to a meagre audience in the back room of a Dublin pub with a television blaring in the lounge. Ignoring the jarring cash register, 3 dozen people sit transfixed by a set of reels learned from his father, interlaced with grace notes and tricks picked up from pipers who are ghosts, who died recorded only by himself, who never learnt music, wrote nothing down, but carried the tunes in their minds, knowing that with their own deaths, dozens of nameless reels would also die. Ennis plays, with due respect for the dead, in his one good suit, a white shirt and tie.
Oh, that's Dermot Bulger, your poem there for Seamus Ennis in Drumcondra, in the voice of Tony McMahon. And McDarry Yates, you grew up in the East Wall, but I gather your dad was an Irish language activist.
Activist, probably in a loose definition of the word. He would be active through the arts, really, in that form. He founded an Irish language theatre company, which did a lot of work, and through corrupting youths in schools, he spread the good word of the Irish language as well, yeah.
Yeah, and you'll obviously be accompanying Dermot at this show in Taylor's Hall.
I suppose initially when I contacted Dermot about this, I wasn't aware that he had this suite of poetry specifically about musicians, but it struck me. I'd spent a long time touring and playing different bits of Seamus Ennis music, and I'd attempted to kind of eulogise him for the benefit of, say, an American audience who wouldn't know who he was, and I made some ham-fisted job of a story about him, about a young man and his bicycle cycling around the country trying to collect music from different people. And it was only when I kind of saw these poems that I thought, well, here's a much better version of the thing I was attempting to do all this time. So I thought, you know, what better than to put the two on stage together by someone who knows what they're talking about.
And Dermot, you did hear, I think, the fiddler John Doherty in Donegal, didn't you, when you were 80?
I hitchhiked across Ireland when I was 15 years of age. And on Easter, 1975 or so, I wound up in a tiny pub in Carrick. And in Carrick, it is near Killybegs in Donegal. And someone said, the last Shannon Key is playing in a pub. And which Shannon Key wouldn't be the right word. But like, there was no posters or anything else. And Doherty was an extraordinary travelling musician, a whole family of musicians. He was born in 1900. I went into the pub and there was a local Garda there. And the local Garda said to me, you're underage, aren't you? And I said, I'm here for the music. And he said, well, I'm going to buy you a half pint of Guinness and nuss it for the slowly for the night. And this man was sleeping upstairs. He came down and he played this extraordinary music for an hour and a half to an audience of local people. And it was like being in royalty. It was like his hands were bursting into flames with the power of the playing. And he was very, very... But what was extraordinary, you were watching a great musician, but you weren't watching him in the concert hall. You weren't watching him on stage. You were watching him among his people, and he was moving on to the next town in a few days, and I felt incredibly privileged to, I got his albums later, but to see him among his people play his music, and this was a way of life, so it was a fascinating experience for me.
Finally, Dermot, your new novel is called The Arc of Light. I love what it sounds. It's kind of finding a kindred spirit across generations.
Well, not long after I met John Doherty, I met Sheila Fitzgerald, and she was 73, I was 18. They seemed impossibly old, and she had she lived in a small caravan, and she didn't leave behind a great body of work, but she left behind an inspiration. She inspired Paul Dawkins, she inspired Pauline Buick, she inspired all kinds of people. She suffered great tragedies, and this is Mother's Day, and she'd lost her son, she'd lost her daughter, she'd lost her granddaughter, and the novel is about what it's like to have a son who's gay in the 1950s and 60s, but it's really about a woman at a time of life when most people settle for a sour sort of compromise, at the age of almost 50, who left her husband and spent the next 50 years living an independent life in Tangiers and all kinds of, and quite, you know, was determined no matter what happened to embrace happiness. And so she was, I had a great teenage years between meeting John Doherty, between wandering around and meeting this extraordinary woman in the field. And so I've spent the last 40 years trying to tell a story and live with her. And so An Arc of Life is my attempt to actually finish her story.
Well, look, Dermot Bulger, McDarry Yates, thanks so much for coming in today. And My Father's Kind, the show, you're both a collaboration of poetry and music celebrating many great 20th century figures in traditional Irish music, is on at the Taylor's Hall in Dublin here on April 12th, all part of Musictown Festival, and the website is musictown.ie. Thanks so much for coming in this morning. Our listeners love Dermot Bulger there. Miriam, wonderful, wonderful, the magical, amazing Dermot Bulger. I love his poetry. His words reach out to all who read or hear them. More, please. That's from Rose Mead, and lots of love for Flo McSweeney. Brian Gorey says, beautiful Flo, well done. My mum passed 3 years ago in February. I have her picture in a frame from my wedding. Thank you for such a sweet Mother's Day song. Deep respect. That's from Ed Bryan. Another says, absolutely stunning Flo McSweeney, beautiful voice, beautiful song. And another says, Aisling says, Flo McSweeney, wonderful. Please tell us the dates of your gigs before the end of the show. Well, we move on. On the 16th of this month, the body of Ruth Maguire, who was on a hen weekend to Carlingford, was found in Carlingford Lock. Ruth was just 30 years old and the mother of three young children. Well, I'm joined now on the line by her sister, Rachel Wilkinson. Rachel, good morning and thank you so much for taking our call.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. And Rachel, thanks so much. I know it's very difficult. So sorry about your beautiful sister. And I know you very bravely want to speak out in a moment about the lack of safety barriers at the pier in Carlingford. But first, would you mind telling me, Rachel, tell me a little about your precious sister, Ruth. Tell me about her.
She was the baby of the family. She was just really good fun. And she was a great mum. She was completely devoted to her children. Three children. She had children very young, so she was always quite sensible, and she sort of was, even though she was the youngest, she was probably more sensible than the other siblings. She was getting married in August, so she was very organised and planning it out ahead, and everyone's really excited about it.
And tell me about the weekend. I know, because I was reading, like, she spent most of her time with her children, but she was on a rare weekend away. It was a hen party, wasn't it, Rachel?
Yeah, Yeah, with one of her friends, Erin, who's getting married. She's getting married in a few weeks' time. Yeah, so Ruth didn't really go out. I mean, you know, she didn't really drink. She just tea on her 30th birthday, and she was always a designated driver. So this was a rare occasion where she maybe had a few drinks. She wasn't even having a head and party for herself.
Mm-hmm. When did you realise, Rachel, there was something wrong?
My mum didn't tell me for a while because she was holding off. So I got told at lunchtime on St. Patrick's Day. At that stage, she'd been missing from the night before. My mum knew immediately, and Jim knew immediately. The minute they found out that she hadn't arrived home from the night out, they knew that something was wrong. We all knew immediately as soon as we knew, because it was so out of character. She wouldn't have ever gone to a party somewhere else, or she wouldn't have met up with a different crowd. She just wouldn't have done that. She was a homebird. She would have just wanted to go home.
And of course, you all then went up to the lock. Tell us about the photograph, Rachel, because that was key to knowing where she was, wasn't it? Shortly before she had disappeared.
Yeah, so the photograph was on Instagram. It was one of my brothers, it was his partner, she spotted it and she sent it across to everyone. So it was a picture of a door. It was actually a video, but she had taken a picture of it. So it was just a white PVC door, and that led the search to the water, because the PVC door was a small cottage just opposite the locks.
And piecing together, Rachel, what you know, and from the PSNI and the Gardaí as well, what do you all think happened now, Rachel?
Well, that's kind of the hard thing. We don't know exactly what happened, because, you know, there's no CCTV. Well, there is in the town, but not down towards the water. So we don't know exactly what happened. So that makes it really difficult, because we know that she was there at that door, and obviously the lock is directly opposite, and we know she ended up in the water. But it's, you know, we don't know. We never know exactly how she ended up in the water.
And you very strongly, don't you, Rachel, want some kind of safety barriers? You think it's very, very dangerous the way it is at the moment.
Well, everyone does. You know, everyone, we've been dying for the candlelight vigil. All the family said, it's so open. You know, even so much as a child could run out of chasing a ball or something. There's no barrier whatsoever. There's a walk, you know, there's a road like that leads to the pier. And even that's quite open. You know, a child could gush a wind and the child's in the water, but, you know, there's a lot of young ones go down and are having a few too many drinks down there. And this could easily happen again.
And I know a safety audit, Rachel, of Carlingford Pier has been requested by one of the councillors in Louth County Council, Antoine Waters, following the tragic death of Ruth. Because he said, after speaking to members of the emergency services, they told him that lighting, CCTV, yeah, and very importantly, a new barrier, they feel it does need to be erected along the pier. So it's not just you and the family.
No. Yeah, exactly. It was the emergency services. They're totally in agreement with us, and we're totally in agreement with them. The only problem is the councillor said that they have to wait until after the inquest and stuff, which we've been told could be next year. And, you know, for us, in the interim, this could happen to another family. This could be somebody else's sister, somebody else's daughter. You know, it's so sad that they're going to wait until after, because it's fairly obvious what happened. You know, Ruth ended up in the water, and, you know, and it can't happen again. And, you know, we would feel that we've let Ruth down. But if we just let this, you know, sit for at least another 9 months or whatever.
And Rachel, this might sound harsh, but what about some people who might say, oh, look, it was so incredibly tragic, but you can't really cordon off an entire lock, that safety barriers, that it's impractical. What would you say to that?
Well, it's not impractical, because, you know, it can be open and closed. And but even when we were saying, just as even if it's closed at night time, you know, there's just, when we arrived down on St. Patrick's Day, there were so many young ones, and, you know, people have a fun, and it's such a great town. It's a lovely town, and there's a real fun atmosphere. But there are a lot of teenagers, you know, older ones, you know, drinking too much. And if the barrier isn't there, in our minds, it will happen again.
How are you all doing, Rachel? Your mum, her husband, who she was about to marry, her three children. Are you all still in shock, or how are you doing?
I think shock's the main sort of emotion at the moment. we're just trying to help each other. We're just, you know, obviously the main focus is on James and, you know, and the three children. You know, we just want to rally around them. And, you know, it's obviously very sad, especially today with Mother's Day, and there's going to be other events coming up, you know, the kids' birthdays and stuff, but we're just, our main focus is just keeping them as happy and as, you know, and getting them back to their routine as much as possible. But it's obviously very difficult because Ruth was so hands-on and just, she had them in so many activities, so we're just trying our best to sort of keep on what Ruth had started.
Well, look, Rachel, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning, and I hope you do achieve what you're trying to do with that lock. Thank you very much, and I'm so sorry what happened to your beautiful sister, Ruth. Well, in front of me now is an award-winning writer and broadcaster, and in her anthologies, The Long Gaze Back, she has championed Irish writers and particularly the female voice. But in her own first collection of essays called Constellations, she tells her own story in her own voice. The reviews have been magnificent, and they're beautiful fragments of memories and musings on a life and her body, where each scar stands for something. And I'm delighted to say that Sinead Leeson joins me now. Morning, Sinead.
Good morning, Marion.
I was reading them yesterday, Constellations. I know everyone writes, you can't just go by reviews, but everyone loves your book.
Well, it's not for me to say, but it's been wonderful. Yeah, people have been really positive. There's been lots of conversations about it. And one of the great things about writing a book is that you get to hear from people, especially when you write a book like this, people want to tell you their own stories, which I love hearing, which is great.
But like Emma McBride, who's a brilliant writer herself, has said about your book, utterly magnificent, raw, thought-provoking and galvanising. This is a book every woman should read.
I hope every man should read too, maybe. But it's funny when people talk about the things that are contained within it and maybe that some of those issues in the book are personal. But I think that the things that I talk about are, you know, they are death and love and families and life and illness, and they're the things that happen to all of us. So it doesn't seem personal to me. It seems more broader than that, I hope.
And when did you decide to write this kind of book, a collection of essays, which are really about your life and, as you say, the big themes everyone experiences?
Yeah, I think I was quite reluctant to write it for lots of reasons. I mean, time is a factor as well. I mean, I've always been a freelancer, so there's that and family commitments and a lot of fear, I think, as well, because a lot of my working life has been around books and talking to writers and being on the other side of the microphone. You get to talk to people who are brilliant at writing, so you have that sense that it'll never be as good as that, and who do I think I am? But it was always sort of nagging away at me, and I think that when it's on your mind that much, there's only one thing to do, is to sit down and actually confront the page. And I felt that there were things I wanted to say, and I think the reason that they're essays as well is that essays, I think, look outwards at the world and help you sort of, you'll hear lots of writers say that writing things down helped them figure things out, and there was lots of things I wanted to figure out about what had happened in not just my own life but other people's lives that I write about in the book, people that are well known, people that are not, people that are close to me, and I think it helped me figure out a lot of those issues and things. So yeah, it took a while now, and it was written in bits and pieces and a couple of 5 a.m. starts and riding on trains and that kind of carry on, but it got finished somehow.
Because you've experienced quite a lot of health issues and you do address those. Tell the listeners about, I mean, first of all, arthritis as a young child, really.
Yeah, and I think when you get ill when you're young, it's a very isolating experience. It becomes very lonely. It started for me, I was literally 2 weeks into secondary school and got this very strange sort of limp, and I'd been really active, and the shortened version of the story is I went to see a doctor who they couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. So it was a lot of time spent in hospital, a lot of time being bedbound, crutches, a lot of operations. So I missed a lot of, you know, 2-3 months of school, first year, second year, third year, fifth year, a lot of time having a lot of surgery. So I missed out on a lot of those sort of fast forming friendships. I mean, people were very good to me, but I did feel like I was out, as I say in the book, in this sort of hinterland. I was left out of a lot of experiences. I was always on crutches. I was always the first. People would hear me before they saw me coming. And I write about an experience of going to Lourdes on a school trip, again, where there was a wheelchair required. Lourdes is very hilly, if you've been there. Mm. And always feeling the object of pity. And anybody who knows me knows that I'm quite allergic to being the object of pity. So, they were very tough years. But as I've said many times as well, I'm a lot of my working life has been about books and reading. They're great years for reading if you're not able to move around or you're in bed or hospital. So I think I wouldn't have had the life or career I have if I hadn't had a lot of time to read because I was ill. I definitely think the two are connected. I say that all the time.
And you write beautifully about, I think, you had to be in a cast which covered three quarters of your body and the bones stayed fused for 20 years until you became pregnant and the pain exploded almost.
Yeah, I had two children very close together, two wonderful kids, and it was my second pregnancy. I think from about 5 months on, what they had done, this operation and arthrodesis, just fell apart when I was pregnant with my daughter, and that pregnancy was quite horrendous, mostly crutches, and she was born a month early, I'm convinced, for that very reason. But I think that there's something about the body, despite all the failings in mine, I think bodies are quite remarkable and the things that they can bounce back from. And the fact that, you know, I had had before those pregnancy, I'd had leukemia, and there was an issue around fertility and all of those issues too. So I wasn't sure if I would even be able to have them. So I for all the kind of giving out I do about the way that my body has let me down, it's often been quite remarkable. And I think all of us go through lives forgetting what it is to be, how lucky it is to be able to walk around, to be mobile, to be able to not be in pain. I think if you're not dealing with those things every day, you never think about them. And I think they are worth thinking about, because we often get caught up in thinking about smaller things and things that aren't as important as being healthy and being alive and being all of those things. And I'm aware that life's very fragile. Like, we don't know what's going to happen to any of us. So I think those illnesses have definitely made me aware of my mortality and how lucky I am. So I feel lucky all the time in terms of to come through those things and to have my children.
But you're remarkably resilient as well. And in a way, it's why Constellations, the essays are so powerful, because you have experienced so much. So going through the arthritis and like very serious illness so young, then life comes along and knocks you back with leukemia. Did you feel angry that you thought, listen, I've had my fair share of sickness here?
Yeah, a little bit of that. With the leukemia, it had been building. And it was diagnosed because I had a massive clot in my lung, which will kill you on its own anyway, without the added leukemia. And I did think, it was more that I remember the night that they told me, which was a really difficult night, obviously. You do have a flash forward of thinking, I had all these plans, I was going to do all these things, I wanted to have, I just got married, I was 6 months married to the day that I was told. And I wanted to have a life as everybody else did. I was only in my 20s. And then this awful news came along, and it was complicated. It wasn't straightforward, the leukemia, because of all the other things going on with the lung. And it was a really, really tough time. But I do think that the teenage years also sort of helped me through the leukemia years, if that makes sense. Yeah. I was used to hospitals. I was used to doctors. They're very overwhelming, frightening places if you're not used to them. So I think from maybe the first night was the first night I was very, very afraid. And then I thought, right, got to get on with this, got to get better. I want to get out of here. I have things to do. So, and that's kind of been my attitude in most aspects of my life, I think, it's stuff to do.
And a theme came through as well about shaving your hair.
Yeah, this is it. Well, I did that before the illnesses.
Yeah,
I did it when I was 15. I was in school. I got into trouble in school for shaving my head. And it was the week I remember Sinead O'Connor was on the Irma Music Awards, and people were making a lot of comparisons about that. But yeah, it's something I just wanted to do. Little did I know that there'd be more head shavings, because obviously with chemotherapy, your hair falls out and it doesn't fall out in one go. So yeah, I haven't done it in a long time, but I loved it. It's very handy, very low maintenance, a little bit chilly in the winter. But yeah, I always kind of, but I used to, yeah, pink hair and blue hair and all those kind of things. I always had a hair thing. So there's an essay about hair in the book, but then like lots of the essays in the book, that essay is not just about me. It's about art. It's about the Les Tendues, the women who were shaved, their heads shaved in the War of Independence and in various wars in Europe. It's about PJ Harvey's song Hair. It's about the pre-Raphaelites. So I wasn't interested in writing a book that was just all about me or my experiences, which is why there's lots of other things and people in this book. So it's good. The trickiness is just trying to pull it all together, you know?
There's one very beautiful bit in the book, I thought, as well. You know, when you became pregnant, you mentioned when you were being driven by your husband to a scan that you began to cry. I assume that was because it was so scary, because your body has been so good to you, but you were worried maybe at that stage.
That's exactly what it was. And I still have that sort of feeling when I walk into a hospital, even to visit somebody, I get a little bit uneasy. I'm watching where the exits are, you know, because I spent so many, you know, a lot of time in there. But driving to that scan, because we had been told I'd had so much chemotherapy, this might not work. I was on a very toxic drug for a long time, one that saved my life and only worked on my leukemia that causes potential fetal damage. And I just thought, this won't happen for me. And if it does happen, I don't know if I'll go down any of those, you know, intrusive IVF roads, because I've spent a lot of time having a lot of things done to my body by doctors and medical people. So I just thought, you know, we'll hope for the best and see what happens. And it did happen. So driving to that scan, I did think, you know, they're going to tell me something terrible, because I've had lots of doctors tell me terrible things. And I really was, I was almost afraid to walk in. And then when you do go in and you have that first early, I mean, it's indescribable, as you know, you know, it's just an incredible moment. So yeah, I feel really lucky. That's what I think all the time, that there's been bad things, but there's been lots of good things.
So where do you get your strength and resilience?
I don't know. I think it gets, some of it is sort of does come from that place of knowing that you could be sitting in hospital, so get on and get out with it. I have an incredible family. My mum and dad are brilliant, very hardworking, very resilient people, who've always been, and we're there, you know, unfailingly all the years, all the driving to appointments, all the physio, all the crutches, making me do the exercises, all the stuff. And my dad's always, particularly my dad's always, you know, worked, you know, in music as well as having a daytime job, and just doesn't know how to sit down and relax. And I think I sort of get that from him. He's a bit sort of like nonstop, like I am.
There's another beautiful piece, actually, and The Guardian had it yesterday as well, about a friend of yours called Rob from years ago, who died young. Tell us about Rob.
Yeah, Rob and I met when we were in college, and we didn't go out straight away, but we eventually started going out, and went out for a couple of years. And even when we broke up, we still stayed friends. We were very good pals. And He had a friend who I met early in 2000, I think, who I really liked. And I remember telling him that I really liked him. And, you know, we had both moved on, had our own lives, and Rob was going out with somebody else. And he sort of went, I'm not sure about that. I think you might be a bit incompatible. I don't think it'll work out. But I really liked this guy, and I kind of thought he might like me. But we were very wary because we both knew Rob. And in the week that we eventually, this man, Steve, and I got together, that was on a Thursday. And 2 days later, we were going to talk to Rob about it. And Rob had a very accidental, catastrophic fall, and he died. And it was just, it was the sort of, I say to people all the time, it was the best week and the worst week of my life, because I hadn't encountered grief that was that sort of rupturing. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of people around that time, Rob's friends and his family particularly. I mean, his family are just incredible people. I'm still very close to them, particularly his sister Louise, who stayed with us during the week when the book launch was on. And I'll see them both in London this week. It was just that there's real unfairness when somebody who's young dies, especially if it's very sudden and there's no... and Rob, you know, in contrast to my life, Rob had never been ill or been sick or had any of these things happen to him. And then one sort of awful mistake, and then he wasn't here. And it was just, it took a long time for, I think, a lot of people, including myself, his family and friends. And the reason yesterday, one of the nicest things that happened with that piece being in The Guardian was a lot of people contacted me to say that they knew him or sent me pictures or sent me stories. People I used to work with, people who went to college with him, went to school with them, all just thinking, you know, it brought him back to life for a moment. You know, he's not here anymore and he's still hugely missed by everybody. And that's what writing can do sometimes. It can sort of resurrect somebody. And now all these people, I'm so glad that all these people are going to know about Rob, who wouldn't have known about him, because he was a really special person, and I wouldn't have met my husband without him. And we both adore him. Our son has his middle name, and we just still, we talk about him a lot, and we tell the kids about him, and we, lots of people I know are still, he's always on people's minds, I think, and I think some people don't ever leave us in a way.
No, and that was lovely, and you brought him back to life in a way yesterday. I almost felt like I knew him and I've never met him, and
we're
forever young.
Yeah, I hope so, and he's, it's very, his family are really special people, and I really wanted to get that right for them and talk to them about it, obviously, all along the way, but he was a lovely, lovely person.
I thought it was a beautiful essay as well, and I was reading some of the comments beneath it when I was in The Guardian yesterday, and just a lot of people said they had lost someone young they loved, a brother, sister, lover, and that the grief that you wrote about is so real, but so many people suffer it but find it difficult to express. But you managed to do it in that essay.
Yeah, and I think this is what I was saying to you about the whole book, that I might be writing about experiences that happened to me, but if you take grief, and I'm writing about Rob and I'm writing about Steve, but I'm writing about a subject that all of us know about, whether it's your grandmother or your neighbour or a stillborn child or whatever that is, all of us have been touched by grief, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's part of dying, is part of living, as we know. And I always just wanted to try and get across what my experience was like. And it's when I mentioned the Lourdes essay as well, people got in touch with me about that, not just about their bad hips or their experiences with faith, but also about experiences with bad doctors or their experience of losing their faith or going on pilgrimage, people who are very religious. And that's the thing, you hear from a spectrum of people who tap into one part of what you're saying. And I loved a lot of people on The Guardian were talking about people that they'd, you know, a friend from years ago, somebody died in an accident, and it's made them remember them for that day. Maybe they hadn't thought about them in years. So we have to remember the dead as much as the living sometimes, I think.
Absolutely. And as well as your new book, of course, you're known, Sinead, for championing writers, especially women's voices in your role. I know you as a journalist, editor of The Long Gaze Back, which is an anthology of women's writing. You've been presenting the RT's book show. But you said that you don't think we hear enough of women's voices or writers. Why do you think that is still?
It's definitely gotten better. And I think with the I edited the two anthologies because I thought that a lot of the history of Irish anthologies was full of, there were predominantly men, and there was often one or two women in them. I think what's happening in the last couple of years in Ireland, there has been a wave of new writing and things have shifted in the way people are telling stories, in essays, in sort of more hybrid experimental writing. We have a history of wonderful poets here. And I think we're more aware now in all areas of life that we do need diversity. We need difference. We need to elevate the voice of people who don't necessarily get heard all the time. And for me, I don't think it's hard to champion other people. I think there's what's missing sometimes in the world, I think, is kindness and remembering that we don't know what's going on in people's lives. We often make assumptions about others. And, you know, just try to be nice to people. It's not difficult to do that. And I do think with women's voices in Ireland, a lot of it's tied into what's happened in Ireland historically with, you know, church and politics and the kind of woman's role in the home and stuff. And that has all changed. Ireland's changed more in the last 10 years than the last 50 or 60 put together, I think. And women's voices are rising up out of that, I think.
Well, the nice thing yesterday is when people were writing about you and giving you great reviews, they all said, oh, she's been so very nice and supportive to all of us writers. So it's kind of a brave thing when you write yourself. So
it's great. Terrifying.
Yeah, but hey, couldn't have gone better, let's be frank. And our listeners as well, really great listening on Miriam this morning. Such strength and determination coming through both Flo McSweeney and Sinead Gleeson. Another says, I feel really, really lucky. There's been bad things, but also really good things. Sinead Gleeson is such an inspiration and her resilience shines through. Niamh texted to say, Sinead Gleeson is truly amazing. She is an inspiration. So Sinead Gleeson, Constellations, your new book. As I say, Anne Enright in the cover says, Sinead Gleeson is an absolute force. If you want to know where passion and tenacity are born, read this book, and it's published by Picador. Thanks so much for coming in. Thrilled
Thank
for
you.
Your success.
Thanks,
well
ma'am.
Done.
Thank you.
And I've been rejoined in studio by the wonderful singer Flo McSweeney, who we heard earlier on singing that beautiful song Picture in a Frame, and she is here this morning with Fiacra Trent, who has produced her new album. Welcome back to you both.
Thank you. We went and had coffee.
Great.
I hope you enjoyed it. Surprisingly lovely in the canteen in RTE.
Yeah, it is lovely coffee. Go back, Flo, because I was saying earlier in my introduction to you that you had a stellar career and you were actually signed by a label which was part of Virgin Records. Go right back. Where did you grow up and how did you start singing?
Well, I grew up in Caventeely, Shrewsbury Lawn in Caventeely, and my family are from Cork originally, and we moved there when I was around 3, and I was always singing, and I think when I was about 17 I joined my first band, which was called Blind Dancer, which I thought was a great name until a band came out called Deaf Actor. So I just went from band to band, and I remember my parents despairing of me while everyone else was going to college. I just wanted to be in a band, and then when I was 19, I actually went away with a dance troupe to Germany and Italy for almost 2 years, and it was like a Hot Gossip type of dance troupe. There was a lot of hanging out of scaffolding. And that was like madness. And I think my daughter's 17 now. If she told me I'm running away with the circus, which is pretty much what I did, I'd freak out and say, no, you're not. But my parents let me go. Different times they were. But I grew up very fast. And when I came back, I got seriously stuck into music and got involved with various bands and never really looked back.
And did you enjoy it? You were so young. I mean, you got fame very quickly, very young.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it? Or you always say you were shy almost.
I was, yeah. and very lacking in confidence. And I think I had a reputation of being a bit cold, when in actual fact, I wasn't at all cold. It was a sort of crippling shyness. So I don't think I really enjoyed it because I lived on coffee and adrenaline and, you know, I loved to sing and I loved to sing live, but I found everything that came with it, fame, etc., was all a bit terrifying.
And of course, beside you is Féachra Trent. I said earlier, you're known for many things, but of course, you're credited and known for the string arrangements on the Boomtown Rats, I Don't Like Mondays, and Fairy Tale of New York by the Pogues. You've also worked with Van the Man, Elvis Costello, Arca Funkel, Sinead O'Connor, The Corrs. I could go on and on and on. Where did you begin your career, actually, Féachra?
I actually did a science degree, but
as you do.
As you do. But music kind of became more and more... I was always into music, and I suppose it was an era when people were expected to have proper degrees and proper jobs, you know. And music was kind of a luxury. However, music won out, and I was fortunate after I finished the science degree, I had a chance to go and study music in the States. I did my master's over there. I actually left Ireland in 1963 and didn't return to live until 91. So that was 28 years. And now, this year, I'm back 28 years, so...
And is it true? Is this, now there could be apocryphal, Féachra. Did you teach Paul McCartney's wife Linda to play the piano?
Yes.
And you did?
Yeah, it's funny you were talking about the, Flo, you were talking about the price of fame. And I remember being there one day and Linda was on the phone to the McCartney office down in Soho Square and she said, oh yes, and some envelopes and some notepaper, please. And I thought, bless her, she cannot walk out of our house and down the street to the local shop to buy those things. That's the toxic price of being a famous, you know, a celebrity.
Did you succeed in teaching her the piano, by the way?
It was more coaching her in...
So that she could be in Wings, wasn't it? So that
she
could
was
in
Wings, but she'd had some criticism for being a passenger, so she felt she should improve her whatever, you know.
Yeah. My listeners go, another fantastic woman's voice, loving listening to the brilliant Flo McSweeney on Miriam. Her new album is incredible, as she is. Others want to know when you're going to be doing gigs as well as your new album, Flo. They're delighted to see you're back.
We have been doing, Féachra and Carmel and myself have been doing gigs. We were in the Mill Theatre a couple of weeks ago. We've Boyle Arts Festival in the summer. We're going to be in Billy Burns in Kilkenny in the coming weeks, beginning of May, and it's called the Sofa Sessions. And I'm hoping that in the autumn, I'm waiting to see how the album does before putting something together to tour it. But I would love, of course, I'd love to tour it. May I also say, Miriam, that the album is also available on CD in Tower Records, Golden Discs, and Eason's, as well as being available on every online platform.
It's called Picture in a Frame. So, how did you choose what songs to put on it, Flo?
I think it was because we were gigging them and we had the luxury of the 2 years of singing live that just songs were just, Carmel and I were both constantly, each of us choosing new songs. So I had I went from having sort of no repertoire to quite a big repertoire, and there are songs that I connect with on an emotional level. Every single song I feel I connect with. So they were the songs that I immediately went, oh my God, I have to do this song. So it just kind of all fell into place quite naturally.
And I was going to say, did you find it difficult to go back out on stage? But of course, you'd been doing a lot of acting on stage. So it wasn't that you gave up singing to bring up your kids and went back years later. You've stayed on stage, really, haven't you?
I have. I did 3 years with Twink in different shows. I was in Menopause the Musical with Linda Martin and Twink. And I was in New York, did a Brian Merriman play, Airbrushed in off-Broadway. And so I've kept the hand in. And I love live work. I really love singing live. I think there's a lovely feeling between an audience and the performer. And when you get that, there's nothing like it. I love singing live.
Are you more confident now singing than you were maybe as the 19-year-old Flo?
Yeah, I'd like to say I'm confident without sounding arrogant. Mm. I just feel I know myself better. And I don't feel that I have to prove anything anymore. I just go out and sing. And I do. I like my voice. I like where I'm at in my 50s.
It's a gorgeous voice. You can't create that, can you, Féachra? Someone either has a nice voice. I often think that. Someone just has a nice timbre in their voice or they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. It's a gift, isn't it?
It's a gift.
Yeah. I actually once said to Flo, the trouble is your affliction is that you've got such a beautiful voice. All you have to do is open and that's it, you know.
I know. And sometimes I oversing then.
No. And actually, actually, I love live radio because Rory Golden just texted to say, I remember delivering Flo McSweeney's documents that contained her publishing contracts to our home in Cabinteely. That was in a previous life in Virgin Records in Ireland. That would have been when you were about 22.
Oh, yeah.
Many congratulations on her album. It's never too late. Too late to follow your dreams.
Thank you, Rory. Hi,
that's
Rory.
So sweet, isn't
thank
it?
You.
And Suzanne texted to say, I've just looked at a review of Picture in a Frame. Wow, what an amazing collection of wonderful songs and brilliant song writers. That's Suzanne. You also do the Maya Angelou quote, don't you? You never want untold stories. Tell us about that.
I think it was from my mother being in the nursing home for the last 4 years of her life. And I would sometimes see in my mother, on days of clarity, I'd see regret. And I don't know what those regrets were. And I think a lot of people come to their end of life and have regrets. And I thought there's a Maya Angelou quote, which is, there is nothing more tragic than the burden of an untold story. And I felt if I don't do an album and tell my story, it would be a horrible regret.
So, well, you've done it. In spades, with the great Fiacre Tramp beside you. And we're going to go out on you singing that lovely song, Leaving the Table, Leonard Cohen song.
From his last album.
Yeah, thanks so much for coming in, Flo McSweeney and Fiacre Tramp. Happy Mother's Day. I want to say thanks on sound today to Cara O'Hare, to Denise Davies, our BCO, and to my producer, Shannon O'Gorman. And we're going out listening to Flo McSweeney singing Leaving the Table.
I'm leaving the table. I'm out of the game. I don't know the people in your picture frame. If I ever loved you or known, it's a crying shame. If I ever loved you, if I knew your name, you don't a lawyer. I'm not making a claim. You don't need to surrender. I'm not taking aim. I don't need a lover, no. The wretched beast has been tamed. I don't need a lover, so blow out the flame. There's nobody missing. There is no reward. And little by little, we're cutting the cord. We're spending the treasure, no, that love cannot afford. I know you can feel it, the sweetness restored. The table, I'm out.